Okay, so Portugal's 18 months of revolution in 74, 75 saw a real flowering of organisation and creativity. Political slogans were not only spray-painted on walls, but also printed on the back of bus tickets. Mm. There were no police to be seen, but also no crime. Lenin's State and Revolution made it onto the bestseller list. Seven-year-olds were apparently able to tell you the names of the myriad of different political parties and groupings and which ones they supported and why. So the revolution started with a coup by disaffected army officers on April 25th, 1974. They got rid of the fascist or proto-fascist dictatorship. And this was then replaced by a military junta. The coup had massive popular support, and many in the ruling class also supported the coup because they decided that the old way of ruling was now a liability and that Portuguese capitalism needed to modernise. But the ruling class got more than they bargained for because the overthrow of the old regime really opened up a political space in which the working class could organise. So, in the revolution's first 2 days, hundreds of political prisoners were freed and then got replaced by 100 of the hated secret police, the PIDI. Thousands of people massed onto the streets in celebration. Well, not just of the secret police, but, yeah, of the revolution in general. Workers sung the Internationale, which was, needless to say, banned by the dictatorship. A statue of an 18th century dictator got covered in left-wing slogans. In this period, there were marches every day. Newspapers and television stations were just full of political manifestos. Posters were up everywhere. Street names got changed. Bridge names got changed. And so on. So May Day in 1974, a few days after the fall of the old regime, was the first May Day celebrated openly in over 50 years. And so the eyewitness Phil Mailer had this to say about the amazing scenes, and I'm just going to read it out in full. He says, "I shall never forget that 1st of May. The noise, the noise, the noise is still ringing in my ears. The horns tooting in joy. The shouting, the slogans, the singing and dancing. The doors of revolution seem open again after 48 years of repression. In that single day, everything was replaced in perspective. Nothing was God-given, all was man-made. People could see their problems and their misery in a historical setting. How can words describe 600,000 people demonstrating in a city of a million? Or the effect of carnations everywhere, in the barrels of rifles, on every tank and every ear, in the hands of troops and demonstrators alike. It is the climax of a week of hectic, fast-moving events. Working people have left an indelible mark on the situation. The call is for socialism, and masses of ordinary people have been involved in making it. What started as a military coup is now assuming new dimensions. The junta is still in power, but it is the people who have called the tune, in particular, the working class. With the working class struggle on the ascendancy, their confidence then infected other oppressed groups. And so a process of popular power, or in Portuguese, poder popular, went on. There were significant land occupations where thousands of hectares of land that weren't being used by landlords were simply taken over. And used both productively and really imaginatively. There are also takeovers of houses and apartments in the cities. The socialist historian Peter Robinson describes how, and I quote, "Unemployed workers helped in the countryside. Children taught adults to read. Popular clinics and cultural centres flourished. People's tribunals were established. A golf course in the Algarve, which is this posh tourist region, declared that it was now open to all, except the members." That's the end of the quote. Women workers at the Timex, watch factory struck for increased wages and also the purging of six secret police informers. They sold their watches, like the, you know, watches they produced, in the streets to raise money for the strike. Women took over a laundry and ran it for free. Women also demonstrated outside the junta's headquarters and demanded that they be given an old fascist building to organise in, as other political groups had been given. Gays and lesbians had suffered horrendous repression under the old regime. Now they released a manifesto of the movement of revolutionary homosexuals, which was published. Other oppressed groups took action as well. So high school students purged their schools of fascists and formed committees made up of students, teachers, and also other school workers. Okay, well, how did it get to this? Portuguese capitalism had been really stagnant. Portugal was the least developed country in all of Western Europe. And so one indication of this is their illiteracy rate was 37%. And the country's ruling class had basically operated for centuries by pillaging Portugal's colonies in Africa, but then neglecting to build up industry at home. And it had hung on to these colonies for longer than the other colonial powers had, and just got massively bogged down fighting against freedom fighters in their wars of liberation. And this had a really huge cost to the economy. So in 1971, the military cost 49% of Portugal's budget. So, you know, basically half. This was really unsustainable. And so Portugal needed to modernise. In the late 60s and early 70s, the regime did attempt policies of liberalisation. But, you know, they were scared of the workers and student struggles that this had sparked. You know, more modest ones, obviously, by comparison to during the revolution. But they quickly pulled back from these policies of liberalisation and went back to the old, you know, trusted methods of repression, and so had no strategy for getting out of the colonial wars, for developing industry, and for, you know, generally modernising Portuguese capitalism. And so when the army officers that were organised in the Armed Forces movement, or the MFA in the Portuguese initials, got rid of the dictatorship, and when they promised democracy, development and decolonialisation, no one mourned the passing of the regime, not even the bourgeoisie. During the 18 months of revolution, governmental power was shared between the military and the provisional governments. But it was the military much more than the provisional governments that called the tune. So often workers would make demands directly on the armed forces movement, the MFA, rather than the government. But the army, it has to be said, wasn't the reliable instrument that the ruling class desired. So, you know, often soldiers would refuse to carry out orders, and there were deep divisions within the army. Likewise, the provisional governments were notoriously unstable. And I think this, like the instability of the army, was really reflective of the weakness of Portugal's bourgeoisie during the revolution. And so typically provisional government would only last a couple of months before being replaced. The other force jockeying for power, of course, at this point was the working class. So the revolution saw a deep radicalisation amongst the working class. And the high point of this, really, I think, was the existence of the interempresas, and sorry for any shitty Portuguese pronunciation, or interfactory committees, which in some ways were like the workers' councils that have been a feature of other 20th century revolutions. So as soon as the dictatorship was overthrown, a strike wave took place. So in the month of May, there's a long list of striking workers, but I'm going to read it out. So dockers, miners, canteen workers, textile workers, typewriters, oil refinery workers, metal workers, taxi drivers, merchant seamen, fishermen, workers in the tourist industry, train conductors, and others struck. Both economic and political demands were raised by workers. And a key demand in the big companies was for saneamiento, or the cleansing or purging of fascist managers. But this then got extended to just include managers who were seen to be against the workers. And saneamiento occurred on a really big scale. So in half of all companies with over 500 workers, this process occurred. In May 1974, the new government sacked 1,000 company directors who were seen to be close to the old regime. And so I think these achievements really demonstrate the strength of the workers' movement. There were also demands for sizable wage increases, improvements to conditions, and a minimum wage. And the workers' action brought significant and immediate gains. So exactly a month after the April 25th coup, so very early on, the government conceded a minimum wage of 3,300 escudos, and workers' wages rose an average of 30%. Workers also forced the nationalisation of many companies. So in March 1975, the Portuguese banks and insurance companies were nationalised. So this meant that 60% of the economy was at that point in state hands. There are numerous times when the army couldn't get workers back to work, or perhaps more accurately, when the soldiers were won over to the side of the workers. So one example was when the Lisnave shipyard workers held a demonstration against the new anti-strike law. The demonstration had been banned by the government and attacked by the Portuguese Communist Party, the PCP. 5,000 demonstrators marched to the Ministry of Labour. And here's a description from a soldier who was meant to go and smash the demonstration. The demonstration began and a human torrent advanced with shouts of, "The soldiers are the sons of the workers. Tomorrow the soldiers will be workers." The commander soon saw that we were not going to follow his orders, so he shut up. Our arms hung by our side, and some comrades were crying. Hundreds of companies were managed by the workers themselves. In hundreds more, workers took over ownership and ran the companies as cooperatives. There were real difficulties with workers' control, though. So, for example, distribution became a huge problem. Where a factory produced consumer goods, well, then it's easy enough for the workers to just sell them directly to others. But if your factory doesn't produce consumer goods, or if it just produces a small component of the final product, then that's not possible. So in many large and more militant workplaces, the workers actually decided not to take over completely, and just decided that they would manage the firms rather than take them over. So a militant worker at the Setenave shipyard said, and I quote, "How can we have workers' control if we don't control the banks? Our attitude is that we want to know everything. We want to control decisions, but we do not take responsibility. We don't believe that we can have workers' control alone." So what starts out as an economic struggle ends up raising the whole question of state power. For the problem of workers' control to actually be resolved, political strategy and politics actually becomes crucial. Okay, well, another thing that happened was workers' control of the press. So workers at the Republica newspaper took over their workplace and controlled the editorial line of the newspaper. The owner of the newspaper was a prominent Socialist Party member, so they were a reformist party and one of the parties of government. So when the workers took over the newspaper, it had an editorial line that was to the left, both of the Socialist Party and the Stalinist Communist Party. And just as an aside, Peter Robinson says that almost all of the Lisbon newspapers at this time had were to the left of both of those parties, which I think is significant. The workers at Republica had a really keen sense of the importance of their actions. And so they said, "We declare to all workers that we struggle to ensure working class control over information. We are only 150 workers, but in a sense, we are representatives of our class, of millions like us. What is at stake is political power and knowing in whose hands it is." When the government tried to use an army body that they'd set up, COPCON, to try to return the paper to the boss, COPCON refused to cooperate and gave the keys back to the workers. And a very similar thing happened at the radio station, Radio Renascenza. Okay, so there were two types of workers' organisations operating at this time. There was the workers' commissions and then the more traditional trade unions. The workers' commissions were the vehicle that workers used to raise their demands and exercise their power at a workplace level. These were usually formed by mass meetings. These commissions really burst onto the scene at a rapid rate. So by the end of the first month of the revolution, workers' commissions had been formed at almost all workplaces in the Lisbon region. And so, as I said, Interempresa, or inter-factory committees, were also formed. And a young woman assembly worker explained that, and I quote, "It was said, why should we be on our own if other people across the road had the same problems? Then we decided to join and discuss things in general. They were a place, a way for people to meet and discuss. The main purpose of these meetings was to defend the revolution." And so I think the dynamic of the working class struggle really pushed naturally towards these kinds of organisations. The Interempresas linked together 24 firms, including some of the largest in Portugal. And they provided a rival centre of power to the trade union federation, the Intersindical, that the Communist Party dominated. So in February 1975, when NATO carried out exercises in Portugal in a clear provocation, the Interempresas organised an important demonstration of 40,000 workers, despite the Communist Party obviously having denounced the demonstration and calling the demonstrators right-wing. And so this was a real achievement. But it has to be said, though, that it was a problem that the revolutionary left concentrated almost exclusively on the Interempresas and ignored the trade unions, when what was actually needed was to work in both, because the Trade Union Federation organised workers that were outside of their Interempresas. The workers' radicalisation also gave confidence to left-wingers and rank-and-file soldiers in the army, where there was also a radicalisation. But this was dependent upon the level of power and organisation that the working class had attained. Because, you know, given the huge risks involved in disobeying orders, soldiers are only going to do so if they sense that the working class is stronger than the capitalist class. So I think a workers' radicalisation is a real precondition to having a radicalisation amongst soldiers. The fullest expression of the army radicalisation was the setting up of a group called Soldiers United Will Win. And this was a rank-and-file organisation that took up soldiers' grievances. It soon spread nationally. And it showed the power of the mass of soldiers when they're organised. So when the army officers refused to allow a minute's silence on the anniversary of the bloody coup in Chile that brought Pinochet to power, the soldiers put bullets in their guns and held their minute's silence anyway. So it was important for the left to relate to this radicalisation in the army, and they did. So a number of members of revolutionary groups were founding members of the Soldiers United will win. But this is different from having illusions in the army as a whole, because the army as a whole is an institution of capitalist rule. And as an institution, the army cannot be won over to the realisation. But obviously the rank and file can be. Given that it was the army officers that had got rid of the dictatorship in the first place, the army was hugely popular amongst the population in Portugal. And this is problematic. The far left did nothing to dispel these illusions in the army, and if anything, it fed them. It operated in the shadow of the left-wing army officers and didn't understand that ultimately it was only workers' power that could extend the revolution and save the revolution. And so eventually, because of this, the capitalist class was able to reassert its control over the army and then with it, Portuguese society. But I'm going to go into that a bit more later. Okay, so in terms of the political forces, first I'm going to talk about the Socialist Party. They were a reformist party, and they were linked to parties like the Social Democratic Party in Germany and the Socialist Party in France. At the outbreak of the revolution, they were tiny. They only had 200 members and virtually no base amongst workers. But during the revolution, they grew rapidly. And they did establish a base amongst white-collar workers. By the end of the revolution, they were the trusted party of government that the bourgeoisie saw as its best option for running capitalism. And they got sort of between 35% and 38% of the vote in elections. So the Socialist Party was the main beneficiary of workers' disillusionment with the Portuguese Communist Party, the PCP. And it was very good. The Socialist Party was very good at using left rhetoric. So, for example, in their party program in 1974, they had the statement that the Socialist Party fights for the total destruction of capitalism. So it could outflank often the Portuguese Communist Party on the left, which, you know, you might think would be that hard given that the Portuguese Communist Party would run around calling striking workers fascists, amongst other things. So in June 1975, the Socialist Party supported the strike of postal workers, but the Communist Party didn't. But then on the other hand, to the middle class and the ruling class, the Socialist Party would portray itself as a moderate, as a safe pair of hands, and so on. And the party leader, Mário Soares, was himself a man of the establishment. So the Socialist Party proved to be a faithful ally of the bourgeoisie, both nationally and internationally. They were in all of the provisional governments throughout the revolution, governments that were not friendly to the interests of the working class. The American state even could see the Socialist Party's potential early on, and so the CIA actually funded it during the revolution. And it also got funding from numerous other capitalist sources internationally. After the revolution, Soares, as Prime Minister, got a loan from the International Monetary Fund and implemented a vicious austerity program where wages were frozen while inflation went up 30%. And today in Portugal, the same Socialist Party is carrying out austerity measures. So much for the total destruction of capitalism. So I think a lesson for revolutionaries from the experience of the Socialist Party is that we shouldn't be complacent. Because where there's virtually no organised reformist force, they can grow rapidly, as they did in Portugal. And so if the revolutionary left won't take the most of the opportunities that present themselves, and there are a lot of opportunities in the Portuguese Revolution, then reformists can be the main beneficiaries of the situation. Okay, the Communist Party. The Portuguese Communist Party had 5,000 members at the time of the coup in 1974, and a substantial base in the working class. They were a hardline pro-Moscow Stalinist party. And they didn't take long to disgrace themselves. So they took two ministries in the first provisional government in May 1974, and within 2 weeks were organising demonstrations against strikes. They slandered strikers as being lackeys of the bosses, ultra-left, and so on. The party played a role for the capitalist class in curtailing the strike movement and in disciplining the working class. In return, they got their snouts in the trough, and so they were the first communist party in Western Europe since 1948 to have ministries in government. The theoretical underpinning for the communist party's politics was a stages theory of how socialism could be brought about. So they argued that Portugal was too underdeveloped for a socialist revolution, and that what was instead needed was an alliance between the working class and other social classes, including the so-called progressive section of the bourgeoisie. And so they would constantly talk about the battle for production. And, you know, this did have an effect on the working class. Obviously, the problem with this is that in capitalist society, the interests of the working class and the capitalist class are counterposed. And so given that the capitalists control production, any alliance with them inevitably means selling out the working class's interests, which is exactly what the PCP did. A mass party that was actually revolutionary, had it existed in Portugal during that time, would have been constantly trying to push forward the inter-empresas and the trade unions, extend the strike wave, and crucially argue to the rest of the working class that the only power they can rely on was their own, not the army, not parliament, thanks, but workers' power. In terms of the revolutionary left, the Maoists were one of the main forces, and they were wildly sectarian towards the Portuguese Communist Party, which, remember, had a mass base in the working class. But, ironically, perhaps they had the same theoretical back page as the PCP, and so they had the same stages theory of how socialism could be reached. The best, I think, of the revolutionary left groups, and there are a lot of revolutionary left groups, but I think the best of them were the PRP-BR. They saw the need for an insurrection to overthrow the provisional government, and they stood for workers' power. But they had some serious hangovers from their Maoist origins. So they didn't take the economic struggle seriously enough. Rather than intervening systematically in every spark of workers' action and putting a premium on what is the next step for the workers' movement, they preferred to simply intervene around political questions, or what they saw as political questions. They downplayed work within the trade unions because the trade unions were less political and more concerned with so-called bread and butter issues than the inter-factory committees, the inter-empresas were. And so one example is the PRP-BR abstained from a major conference of delegates from 124 workers' commissions because it was dominated by the PCP, they said, and the demands were reformist. And so, you know, this kind of thing just left the field open for parties like the PCP and like the Socialist Party. So the PRP, refused to seriously fight to win over workers who were shifting to the left. They also capitulated to the non-partyism that became popular during the revolution and downplayed the importance of revolutionary socialist organisation. And so, you know, they'd neglect the importance of winning people over to their group and clearly identifying as party members. So often there wouldn't be party banners or very few of them on demonstrations. And so this meant that the question of the need for a revolutionary party and not just simply having organisations like the workers' commissions, this was never sharply posed in the Portuguese Revolution. And a final serious weakness of the PRP-BR was their guerrillaism. There were threats from the right, both real and imagined. And the bloody coup in Chile was still fresh on people's minds. And so the PRPBR supported an insurrection to defend the revolution. But what they meant by this was an insurrection on behalf of the working class, carried out by themselves and some left-wing army officers, and not a mass working class insurrection. And so they cited the example of Cuba as being one where working class support would increase after the revolution. And so I think this impatience and this looking for shortcuts and the failure to decisively break with their Maoist origins meant that, you know, tragically, the best of the revolutionary groups did not carry out any effective political preparation amongst the working class to seize power. And so the revolutionary left... The revolutionary left had opportunity after opportunity to grow and to win over large sections of the working class to the position of the need to take over state power. But really, they just pissed these up against the wall by and large and left the field open to the Communist Party and the Socialist Party. So it wasn't that the working class was lacking in courage or determination, but what was lacking was leadership from their organisations. Very late in the piece, Building Workers demonstrated the power of the working class. This was a group of workers that hadn't played much of a role up until that point. Thanks. But in October 1975, they called a national strike, held a mass demonstration, armed themselves en masse, and held the parliamentarians hostage until their demands were met. You know, as you do. And all their demands were met. So, you know, I think had there been a large revolutionary party with the right politics, these would have been the people that you'd be looking to. Okay, so how does it all end? Well, workers defeated two right-wing attempted coups during the revolution that happened in... one was in September 1974 and then another one in March 1975. And so because the capitalist class was in such disarray, there were sections of it that wanted to reimpose an authoritarian right-wing regime because they were just so alarmed by the workers' radicalisation. So I'm just going to give you a flavour of how workers stopped the authoritarian right from reimposing itself. So I'm just going to describe the March 1975 one. Military organisation was carried out by COPCON. Workers responded magnificently and saved their revolution. When an army barracks in Lisbon was attacked by the right, within hours of the attack, barricades were set up along the main roads out of Lisbon and Porto and to the border with Spain, sometimes with the use of expropriated bulldozers, lorries and cement mixers. Soldiers fraternised openly with workers manning the barricades and some handed over arms. Armed workers searched cars. Strikers at Radio Renascenza went back to work and occupied the radio station in order to defend the revolution. And that was a quote from Peter Robinson, sorry. And so the coup attempt was defeated and the workers' movement and also the forces of the revolutionary left were strengthened. But things couldn't just continue forever as they were. Because in a situation where political power is not completely in the hands of the capitalist class, when society's two main classes are facing off against one another, one side has to win out eventually. The provisional governments were not stable. The ruling class was unsure of itself and divided. Discipline in the army had largely broken down. And so there was no reliable apparatus that could carry out the government's orders. And right up until November 25th, 1975, which in hindsight was the D-Day of the revolution, revolutionary opportunities existed. And so, for example, the building workers' strike that I just mentioned occurred only weeks before the end of the revolution. And yet there was no revolutionary socialist party of any size, only dozens of competing groups, and each with their serious weaknesses. And so in the end, the Great Portuguese Revolution ended not with a bang, but with a whimper. The right in the army moved against the left, sacked the left-wing commander, and the government declared a state of emergency and sent in hand-picked commandos. None of the left groups called for strikes and occupations to defeat the right. It was all over. So, just to conclude, I hope I've given some sense of the magnificent potential of the working class to reshape society through the process of revolution. This is one lesson that we can draw from Portugal, where workers' revolution was brought to Western Europe for the first time in 40 years. But the second lesson is that in the absence of revolutionary leadership, a revolution can't be successful. The betrayals of the Communist Party, who claimed to stand for socialism, and the failures of the revolutionary left meant that the revolution was unsuccessful in bringing socialism about. And yet the Portuguese Revolution got rid of years of fascism and brought in at least parliamentary democracy. This was far short of what Portuguese workers were fighting for, but it is an achievement nonetheless. The revolution put the question of socialism onto the political agenda. The dream of a world run not by bosses and not by bureaucrats, but run by ordinary workers, this was posed concretely. And so I'm just going to finish with a quote from one strike bulletin. And it says this: "Our struggles are just, and if we strike, we shall be heard. This is why we must organise not only against this or that boss, in this or that factory, but against the capitalist system as a whole. Comrades often ask, if there were no bosses, who would give us work? We all know that to work we need a factory, machines and raw materials. We also know that the factory and machines were made by other workers, just as it was workers who sewed the cotton, worked the wool or dug up the iron ore. It therefore isn't the boss who gives us work, but the miner, the metal worker, the farmer. Since it is workers like us who run the factory, why are bosses needed?" And so I think the July 17, 1974 strike bulletin from the workers at a place called Efikec Intel had it spot on. Thank you.